A lot of businesses in Lower Manhattan were flooded out of their offices by Hurricane Sandy. The National Book Foundation is among them, but that did not stop the organization from hosting a big party last night to announce the winners of the National Book Awards. And as NPR's Lynn Neary reports, organizers are hoping the Book Awards will have a bigger impact this year than they have in the past.
In recent years, the National Book Awards have been criticized for nominating too many little-known authors and ignoring big names. The award, some people whispered not too softly, was losing its allure. In response, the National Book Foundation looked for ways to attract more attention. This year, they announced the finalists on morning TV, and a number of well-known writers were included among the nominees. Executive Director of the National Book Foundation, Harold Augenbraum, insists there was no change in the way the awards were judged, but he says the National Book Awards should have a higher profile.
We are trying to make to attract more attention, because I think that the more attention you attract will help us meet our goals, and our goals really is to get more people to read good literature and good writing.
The award ceremony already has its share of glitz. For several years now, it's been held in an ornate venue on Wall Street, just steps away from the New York Stock Exchange. Tim Siebels, a finalist in poetry, says he's not used to so much glamour.
The whole scene, I've never been in anything like this in my life, you know? I mean, it's like an Oscars for writers, right?
Louise Erdrich, nominated for her novel The Roundhouse, has been a finalist twice before.
It's all the more meaningful when you're older and you're writing, because you don't know if your years of writing at your very best are behind you.
The Roundhouse is both a coming-of-age story and a novel of suspense, but it also sheds light on the problems Native Americans have getting justice. And Erdrich says she hopes the National Book Awards will help bring a wider audience to the book, because she wants more people to be aware of that issue.
Recently, the New York Times reported on the lack of funding for tribal police and the enormous disparity in justice, and especially reservations, and especially for women.
Erdrich will have a chance to see if the award does have the power to attract attention. She was the winner in the fiction category. Catherine Boo, who won the nonfiction prize for her book Behind the Beautiful Forevers, also hopes to focus a spotlight on an overlooked community, a poverty-stricken neighborhood of Mumbai. In accepting the award, she thanked the people of that community for allowing her to tell their story.
And if this prize means anything, I think it's this. It's that small stories in so-called hidden places matter. And one of the reasons that they matter, I think, is because they implicate and they complicate what we generally consider to be the larger story in this country, which is the story of people who do have political and economic power.
Other winners last night were David Ferry for his collection of poems and translations, Bewilderment, and William Alexander, author of Goblin Secrets, in the Young People's Literature category. And novelist Elmore Leonard was honored for his distinguished contribution to American letters. Leonard says he was just starting what he thought might be his last novel when he got the news.
And I thought, with this kind of boost coming out of nowhere, how could I be working on my last book?
So, if nothing else, the National Book Awards this year will assure that Elmore Leonard will keep on writing. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Audie Cornish. We're heading towards that time of year when self-help industry publishers are rubbing their hands together in anticipation. The holiday season and the inevitable New Year's resolutions that follow tend to turn our minds towards happiness. Getting it, keeping it, maintaining it. But journalist Oliver Berkman says whatever your plan, you are most likely doing it wrong. Berkman, a self-described skeptic, talks with psychologists, life coaches, and other experts to figure out what works in his new book, The Antidote, Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking. And Oliver Berkman joins me now. Hi there, Oliver.
Hi.
So let's start with your premise. How are we going about happiness in all the wrong ways?
I think the premise from which I start is this idea that we have become fixated on the idea that relentless positivity and optimism is exactly the same thing as happiness, that the only way to achieve anything worthy of the name of happiness is to try to make all our thoughts and feelings as positive as possible, to set incredibly ambitious goals, to visualize success, which you get in a million different self-help books. Whereas actually there's a lot of research now to suggest that many of these techniques are counterproductive, that saying positive affirmations to yourself in the mirror can make you feel worse, and that visualizing the future can make you less likely to achieve it. And so what I wanted to do in this book was to explore what I ended up calling the negative path to happiness, which involves instead turning towards uncertainty and insecurity, even pessimism, to try to find a different way that might be more durable and successful.
And you go on a kind of eat, pray, love search to find it, right? You do a lot of travel, and the book actually opens with you in the nosebleed seats of a mass motivation seminar,
right,
with one of the speakers being former President George W. Bush.
Indeed, I thought that I ought to first of all plunge deep into the heart of this positivity culture, what I ended up calling the cult of optimism, before then setting off to explore the alternative. So I was there, one of 15,000 people, I think, at something called Get Motivated. Former President Bush was indeed one of the speakers. There were a whole day of various speakers, one of whom I think really gave voice to the classic approach when he said that the way to achieve success was to eliminate the word impossible from your vocabulary. And this was really the idea, that you should just refuse to acknowledge that failure can happen. So it was with a certain sort of schadenfreude, I'm afraid, that I discovered later on that the business that he ran had gone bankrupt operating along these principles. And I think they do provide a short burst of some good feeling to the people who go, but I just don't think it lasts. And I guess that's good enough for the business model of people who run motivational seminars.
So what's behind this? I mean, are you basically saying that sometimes the pursuit of happiness is just the pursuit of not being uncomfortable or not being vulnerable?
Yes, I think that what is counterproductive about all these efforts that involves struggling very, very hard to achieve a specific emotional state is that by doing that, you often achieve the opposite. It's a version of the old sort of parlor game that if you try really hard not to think about a polar bear, that the only thing that you can think about in that context is polar bears. And if you go back through the history of philosophy, spirituality, the Stoics of ancient Greece and Rome, the Buddhists, and then also linking up with contemporary approaches to psychology, you find something else, which is actually that trying to let those feelings be and not always struggling to stamp them out is a more fruitful alternative.
One of the funny moments of the book is when you are trying to embrace some ideas of stoicism, and you do this exercise that involved your commute on the subway in London.
Right. This was an exercise that was given to me originally by the great psychotherapist Albert Ellis, who sadly since died. And one of his suggestions was that if you have a real problem with embarrassment, you should deliberately embarrass yourself in order to bring your beliefs about how terrible that would be into direct confrontation with reality. So he suggested that his clients should ride on the subway and speak out loud the names of the stations in the carriage before they arrived at them. When I thought about doing this, when I told other people about it, everyone seems to agree it's just a horrifying thought that you would be saying those things out loud. What's fascinating is when you do it, it's still pretty awful, actually, but it is not anywhere near as bad as those beliefs that I'd held previously. You know, I didn't get arrested, I didn't get attacked, I didn't explode. It was just slightly uncomfortable. It was an incredibly powerful realization in that one specific context, because it really makes you realize how swiftly and unconsciously our beliefs about bad things and our anxieties jump ahead to these infinitely terrible scenarios that just aren't justified by the situation.
So, Oliver, you write a column studying advice literature and self-help books. And over the years, are there things that just drive you crazy about it?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, that's in many ways what this book grew out of, is seeing that the vast majority of what I was encountering wasn't backed up by my attempts to put it into practice in my personal life, and that a certain portion of it actually was. And I wanted to look for what united those things. I think anything that is based around eliminating words from your vocabulary, like the word failure or impossible, I know they don't necessarily mean it quite literally, but that idea that you should just deprive yourself of the ability of confronting certain things as a way to pretend that they don't exist, I think is incredibly annoying. I also have many problems with the kind of positive thinking that's in books such as The Secret, I have to say, which involve just literally, as far as I can tell, focusing on the idea of becoming very rich and successful and just waiting for it to happen.
Oliver, after all of this, are you happy?
Yes. I think what I've really learned is to have a lot of different tools at my disposal for when I'm not. It's not that I sail through life in some completely serene state, but that the problems and the obstacles and the irritations can be dealt with more swiftly when you are not locked into this idea that you have to stamp them out, that you have to make yourself feel motivated, for example, before you can get on with things that need doing, that there's something terribly, terribly wrong with not feeling incredibly excited and cheerful every moment of the day.
Oliver Berkman, writer for The Guardian and author of the new book, The Antidote, Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking. Oliver, thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.
This is NPR.
The Virgin Mary is one of Christianity's most familiar icons. For centuries, artists have depicted her, from ancient frescoes in churches to paintings by Renaissance masters to simple backyard statues. But few writers have taken up her story or tried to create their own version of the epic events of her life. Now the Irish writer Colm Tobin does just that in his novella The Testament of Mary. In doing so, Mr. Tobin raises questions, not only about the life of Mary, but about the stories that laid the groundwork for the creation of a church. NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
Colm Tobin grew up in Catholic Ireland at a time when devotion to the Virgin Mary was widespread. But he found the inspiration for his fictional account of Mary's life not in Ireland, but in Italy. While on a trip to Venice, Tobin happened upon two very different works of art, Titian's Assumption, depicting a red-robed Mary being taken up into heaven surrounded by angels, and a painting of the Crucifixion by Tintoretto.
And I was absolutely struck by the difference between the two images. One, pure, the way they wanted her to be, arising, you know, into heaven, and the other, impure, chaotic, cruel, strange, unforgettable.
It is the space between these two images that Tobin explores in The Testament of Mary. This brief novella takes place many years after the crucifixion. Mary is being watched over by two of her son's followers. She has nothing but contempt for her son's disciples, always has, from the first moment she saw Jesus preaching to them and heard a false note in his voice.
She calls them misfits, only children, stammerers, men who could not look women in the eye. And They sort of appalled her because the language that they were using did not seem to her to be right.
This Mary is neither pious nor pliant. Instead, she is filled with anger. Tobin says he based her voice in part on the fierce heroines of Greek tragedies, Medea, Electra, Antigone. Through her eyes, we see anew familiar stories of the New Testament, the wedding feast at Cana, the resurrection of Lazarus. Tobin says he used the Gospels as a resource until the beginning of the crucifixion, when Mary first sees the crown of thorns.
Then I had to just leave the Gospels aside, leave all sources aside, and begin to imagine what would that be like if you had known this man as a baby, if you had nurtured this child, if you were a woman who had nurtured him, to see him trying to pick out, pull at the crown of thorns and actually pushing the thorns in even further. So I was trying to imagine it second by second, moment by moment, as though it had not happened yet.
One of the disciples now taking care of Mary is John, who wants her to confirm the stories he is writing down in his gospel. He wants to place a grieving Mary at the foot of the cross. Mary knows her son's followers want her to help them to tell the world that Jesus was the Son of God, but she will have no part of it.
I whispered it again, slowly, carefully, giving it all my breath, all my life, the little that is left in me. I was there, I said. I fled before it was over. But if you want witnesses, then I am one, and I can tell you now, when you say that he redeemed the world, I will say that it was not worth it. It was not worth it.
Tobin's Mary seems so unlike the iconic blushing virgin or tragic mother figure that has been handed down over the years that some readers may find her almost unrecognizable. And says Tobin, he knew even as he was writing the book that he was creating a controversial figure.
Yes, I realized that at sometimes when I was working that I was breaking glass. And yes, I was aware that the figure speaking was not the mild woman of the paintings, the imploring and very yielding woman that you see at the foot of the cross or that you hear about in the Gospels, that she was somebody who was deeply traumatized and very angry and also sharp and also intelligent and also ready to defend herself if necessary.
The Gospel of John, of course, does not tell the story of Jesus, according to Mary's testament. There are, says Tobin, two competing narratives in his book, and he insists that he makes no judgment on which is closer to the truth.
That's too large a question for me. I'm interested only in her voice and what somebody like her might have said had the time arisen 20 years after the crucifixion to speak for once. But those large questions over what's right or wrong or over should things have happened one way or the other, really don't interest me. I'm concentrating entirely on the tone and texture of this woman's voice in this particular day.
Do you think it's possible that people who, people of faith, people who believe in Christianity, would be offended by this book?
Well, in the end, she has to say that from her point of view, when they're talking about those large questions of redemption, that all she's to say is, look, I was there, I saw the cruelty, I saw the hours passing, and I can tell you one thing, it wasn't worth it. Now I do realise that this is not ideal if you, for example, pray to the Virgin Mary, which a lot of people do, or if you worship her. But on the other hand, a book is closed. You have to open it to read it. And also, I'm a citizen of the European Union, where, and indeed I'm in the United States at the moment, where the freedom to imagine and publish is one of the things we have all worked for over a number of centuries. And so I'm insisting on my right to imagine how she might have spoken on a given day. But obviously, I would also insist on someone else's right not to open the book.
At the very least, Tobin says, he hopes that believers and non-believers alike will approach his portrait of Mary with an open mind and will understand that he took his subject matter seriously. I wanted to allow Mary to speak, he says, in the same way that artists of the Renaissance wanted to paint her robes and her suffering and her yearning. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Stephen Skip.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Novelist Ian McEwan has won the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Booker Prize, and the Whitbread Award, but his latest novel, Sweet Tooth, has not won the affection of our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, who usually counts herself among McEwan's fans. Here's her review.
Ian McEwan's Sweet Tooth is that oddest of literary achievements, an ingenious novel that I compulsively read, intellectually admired, and increasingly hated. By the time I got to McEwan's last sneer of a plot twist, I felt that reading Sweet Tooth is the closest I ever want to come to the experience of watching a snuff film. Think that's harsh? Open up Sweet Tooth and find out what McEwan thinks of you, dear reader. particularly if you're a woman, as most readers of fiction are. Our heroine here is a young woman named Serena Froom, who devours 19th and 20th century fiction, everything from Jane Austen to Jacqueline Suzanne to Muriel Spark. Several times in Sweet Tooth, Serena discusses her reading tastes, much to the exasperation of her brainy novelist boyfriend. Serena says, "I wanted characters I could believe in, and I wanted to be made curious about what was to happen to them. Generally, I preferred people to be falling in and out of love. It was vulgar to want it, but I liked someone to say, 'Marry me,' by the end." Later on, Serena adds, "I didn't like tricks." Oh, what fun McEwen has squirting acid over everything simple Serena, clearly the common female reader, enjoys in a novel. McEwen deploys his great gifts of storytelling to draw readers into an intricate plot about Serena's career during the 1970s working as a low-level operative for MI5, the British Internal Intelligence Service. Then, by novel's end, McEwen ridicules us readers for ever believing in Serena and the fictional world he's blown breath into. McEwen's title, Sweet Tooth, refers to both a clandestine operation Serena carries out and to the mind candy lure of fiction itself. Certainly as much as it is a suspense tale, a novel of ideas, and a political meditation on the decline of Britain in the 1970s, Sweet Tooth is also a cynical novel about the art of fiction and its pointlessness in the larger scheme of things. As the story goes, beautiful Serena is recruited into MI5 by her lover at Cambridge, a history professor who's one of the many brilliant, narcissistic, and essentially mean men whom she falls for. After graduation, Serena moves into a damp bedsit in London and enters the intelligence service at a time when the glass ceiling for women was ankle high. She diligently files and smiles until the day that her expertise as a novel reader is called upon for a mission dubbed Sweet Tooth. MI5 wants to secretly fund fledgling writers and artists whose work it deems anti-communist in sympathy. Serena is dispatched to entice a fiction writer named Tom Haley into the operation. And as preparation, she reads the short stories he's written, which McEwen himself, of course, concocts and scatters throughout this novel. Violating one of the cardinal rules of tradecraft, Serena falls in love with Haley, even as she's tormented by the fact that she's concealing her true identity as a secret agent. As he has in previous novels like Atonement, McEwen revels here in breaking the fourth wall between his fictional world and our own. For instance, real-life Brit writers, living and dead, like Martin Amis and Ian Hamilton, turn up in scenes and schmooze with Tom and Serena. Tom's short stories all revolve around the themes of love, betrayal, and fakery, and so they explicitly comment on the larger tale this novel tells. Betrayal certainly dooms the relationship between Serena and Tom, as well as the relationship, built on an illusion, after all, between the reader and this novel itself. What sets Sweet Tooth apart from McEwen's other work, however, is the tone. There's a degree of nastiness here, particularly in that genderized disdain for female readers, as well as in McEwen's cool dismissal of the products of his own imagination. Postmodernist writing can have humor and heart, but in Sweet Tooth, McEwen's postmodernist narrative tricks simply serve as weapons of mass destruction. The novel is exposed as little more than a mental game, and Serena, whom we've grown attached to, is brutally silenced. All that remains is a reader's grudging recognition that McEwen, our author god, is awfully clever. Call me sentimental, but that's not enough.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Sweet Tooth by Ian McEwen. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. back to a time when your imagination could be whisked away to faraway lands with just four little words.
Once upon a time.
The classic opening line of your favorite bedtime stories, some of which can probably be traced back to one book, Children's and Household Tales by the Brothers Grimm, first published 200 years ago. And ever since, the Brothers Grimm have lived on through their classic stories.
The tales that everybody knows are only a handful of them, really.
This is Philip Pullman. You may have heard of his novel, The Golden Compass, part of his popular series, His Dark Materials. Pullman's latest book is called Fairy Tales from the Brothers Grimm.
We could probably count them on the fingers of one hand. Cinderella, Little Red Riding Hood.
Hansel and Gretel, Rumpelstiltskin, and Rapunzel. We all know their stories, but ever heard of Thousand Furs?
The king's wife is dying. She's a very beautiful woman, golden hair. And she says to the king, if I die, don't marry anyone else unless she's as beautiful as I am or she's got hair as golden as mine.
The queen dies, and one day the king realizes the only woman as beautiful as his wife is his daughter.
And he says, that's it, I'll marry my daughter. And the counselors say, oh, your majesty, you can't do that. It's a terrible sin. It's forbidden. No, you mustn't do that. I'm determined to do it, he said. I'm going to marry my daughter. I'm in love with her and I shall marry her.
So the princess runs away, wearing her thousand fur cloak, and ends up in another kingdom, and like Cinderella, goes to a ball and meets her future husband. It's one of the darker fairy tales that Philip Pullman discovered when he went back to the original stories by the Brothers Grimm. He also learned where the Grimms found their stories.
I thought, before I began looking into this, that they'd walked here and there in Germany with their knapsacks and their notebooks and talking to peasants and saying, tell me a story. But no, not a bit of it. They were academics. They lived a quiet life. And all the stories that came to them from friends and relations. And they wrote them down and they altered them a little bit. Because, of course, oral stories are not a text in the way that a great poem like Paradise Lost is a text. It exists as words on paper. That's what it is. But an oral story is something told. And these stories in Grimm are a sort of snapshot of something in movement. They're freezing something that was in motion. So I thought I was entitled to, I was justified in my wish to alter them again and tell them as I would if I were telling them orally, if I'd heard the story and wanted to pass it on to somebody else.
Your version of these fairy tales are a little different from versions that many of our listeners may have grown up with. For example, the frog prince who becomes friends with a human princess in the fairy tale. This is actually called the frog king in the original.
Yes. The whole title is The Frog Prince or Iron Heinrich. Now, Iron Heinrich.
Someone I wasn't even familiar with.
I didn't even know
he existed.
He's the servant of the king who spent all this time sorrowing for him. And he was so sorrowful he had to have iron bands put around his heart to stop it bursting. Now, that's an extraordinary idea, but it's not the main part of the story. The main part of the story that we think we know about the Frog Prince, the one incident that everybody will remember, is she kisses the frog and he turns into a prince.
A handsome prince, yes.
Well, no, he doesn't. She throws him against the wall with a great splat, and he falls down in the form of a prince. That's what you get in Grimm.
It's not very romantic.
Which is odd, really, because, you know, the kiss is now part of our own mythology, our own sort of folk understanding of the story. And it makes a lot of sense. You know, you kiss something and you treat it tenderly, you treat it with love, and it turns into something worth loving. But I thought I couldn't put the kiss in if it wasn't in Grimm. In the British version of the folktale, she has to cut his head off.
Oh, goodness.
So there's a lot of bloodshed. A lot of bloodshed.
Interesting also, the role of women in these stories. It was the mother, not the stepmother, who wants to abandon Hansel and Gretel in the forest. When we think of that story, the popular retelling, we think of the stepmother. But in the original, it was the mother.
Well, that's right. This is one of the changes that Wilhelm or Jakob Grimm made in their later editions of the stories. They got more and more pious, more and more overtly Christian. I suppose it was the temper of the times, and they wanted to be more and more respectable and do away with some of the rather shocking things. Another thing they did away with was Rapunzel. Remember, she was in her tower and she let down her hair.
Yeah.
Well, in the first edition of their collection, she says to the witch, why is it that my clothes don't fit anymore? And that's how the witch knows that she's been visited by the prince, because she's pregnant. But that had to go because it wasn't very respectable. So in their later versions, she says, why is it that the prince is so much less heavy than you are, old grandmother or something? Which is a silly question, but it was more respectable than to have her being pregnant.
I wonder, then, what you think about the morals to these stories. We often think about these fairy tales as having some kind of moral grounding, some lesson.
Yeah.
Do you think that's what they're for?
No, not expressly. They do have a moral, but it's a pretty obvious one. If you behave well, you'll be rewarded. If you behave badly, you'll be punished. You could try and extract a more precise moral from stories like Little Red Riding Hood. Don't talk to strange wolves in the woods. But they were intended to entertain. But because we are moral beings, if we tell any sort of story, there will be rewards and there will be punishments and there will be people who do wrong things and people who feel shame or guilt about it and people who behave well and are rewarded. So we can't really help making stories moral narratives because we're moral beings.
I understand that you've been working on a new sequel for your series, His Dark Materials.
That's right, yeah.
I wonder how delving into these tales, spending so much time with the grim fairy tales, how has that influenced your own writing in this particular project?
These stories move very quickly. There's not an ounce of narrative fat in them. They go very, very swiftly from event to event. And another thing is you see very few adverbs in them.
Mm.
So I'm trying to cut down on my adverbs.
A lot of verbs. There's a lot of action.
Well, you choose the right verb and you don't need an adverb to qualify it.
Philip Pullman, his latest book is called Fairy Tales from the Brothers Grimm. Philip Pullman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure talking to you.
And you can hear Philip Pullman reading one of his favorite Grimm fairy tales, The Musicians of Bremen.
Ah, shrieked Lefty, and that woke up the cockerel who crowed, cock-a-doodle-doo!
On npr.org.